Next week, when I am away, John Conley, a member of this church, who could grace any pulpit, anywhere with distinction, will speak to you. The first thing I have to tell you is that this is not the sermon I promised last week. There was a meeting with someone on Wednesday that put that sermon on hold and compelled me to talk about something else. If you were not here last Sunday, my story will not make full sense, so I must recap that sermon quickly. We talked about the great dilemma for sensitive and honest people. If God is all-loving and all-powerful, both at once, why did he make a world like this one? Not the part that has sunsets and wildflowers and mountain lakes and the Flint Hills, but the other part. The world of parasites that slowly eat their hosts from the inside. The world of disease and starvation, of predator and prey, of earthquakes and volcanoes, of floods and cyclones, leprosy, malaria, polio, congenital defects, awful deformities, you name it, the list goes on forever. We said the only way a human being can understand the love of God is by knowledge of what our love is like. And there is not a one of us, surely, who would not make a million changes in this world if we had the power. So I spoke of what is called process theology, a way of understanding God in which he is infinite love, but not infinite power, so that he cannot be blamed for all the innocent suffering on this earth, must, in fact, depend upon us to change the world where we can and to offer love and support where we cannot. I don't know whether anyone found it helpful, nor did I fret much about whether you believed it. We enforce no creeds in a congregational church. We simply covenant together to walk in the way of God and to interpret his word in the most honest way each of us can. We ask of the one who speaks from the pulpit that he challenge our thought. And last week, perhaps the challenge was a little less orthodox than usual. But once in a while, in some odd coincidence, life imitates art. The phone rings, and all of a sudden, the theory you presented on Sunday sprouts right in the middle of somebody's ruined life, so that the sermon is not academic anymore, but a face full of pain and puzzled eyes trying to find an answer. It was on Tuesday evening, around 7, when the voice on the phone spoke my name, told me his, and said, "You may not remember me, but I was in your English class several years ago. I had very good reason to remember him. But there had been a part of his life before he came into my class that I hadn't known about until he told me. And I now have to fill in that missing part so that you will know why I am bothering to tell you this story. Please picture an 18-year-old boy, strong, good-looking, full of careless laughter and good times, probably a little wild, not always careful in judgment, a boy about to become a man. As he celebrates his birthday, I want you to watch him do what you have done. Run joyously down the beach at a beautiful lake, feeling the sand spurt under his bare feet, loving the play of healthy muscle, of his speed into the wind, of the promise of cool water on his sweating body. The world is a good and glorious place. He is with friends, love, courtship, and marriage lie just beyond the edge of the closest sand dune, and beyond that a little, a job, and a home, and children. He would have those things too. There is only one hitch. Ray has forgotten what somebody probably told him once. When he gets in up to his knees, running hard, he arches his back, dives headlong into the lake, and in one terrible instant, the universe plays its cruel trick. The action of wind and waves had built a little sandbar under the water. Ray's neck hits it and snaps, and that evening, they tell him, "You will never walk again for the rest of your life." You can imagine the long, lonely fight to find some reason to go on living. But in the years before I met him, Ray had already won that battle. And when he was confident enough at last to come in a wheelchair to school, he came into my class with a broad smile on his face, ready to get a degree and find a job and make his own way as much as possible. He was still ruggedly handsome, but his limbs had shrunk by now, and his stomach was bloated. He gripped a pencil in his fist, awkwardly, and wrote more slowly than the rest, but he asked no favors. I gave him none, I suppose, except that I came to love his courage and his hopefulness, and encouraged him in every way I could. After he left my class, I saw him at times on campus, and we talked. And when another one of my students came to love him and said yes to marriage, I marveled at her strength and enjoyed his happiness. They were married in Cindy's church, and I went to the wedding just to let Ray know how much I hoped they would have a good life. I lost track of him after that, and some years went by, like weeks, until on Tuesday the phone rang, and I heard a voice I remembered even while he was telling me that I wouldn't. He caught me up on his life, proud of a job he had gotten with the Army at Leavenworth, despite his handicap, and how he and Cindy had bought a house and learned how to be happy. Until, he said, about 2 years ago, when bad luck came calling for the second time in his life, he began to have serious neurological problems, and it was discovered that a cyst had grown inside his spinal cord from the point of his old injury to the base of his brain. He went to Denver for a painful surgery that turned out to be a failure, and there were others with suffering so bad afterwards that he considered killing himself as the best possible gift to both of them. He laughed on the phone, believe it or not, at the joke life had played on him. He said, I guess I should have taken my life when I could do it, Doc, because this looks like it will be the end of me, long and slow, and now I don't have the strength or the means to hurry up the process. The reason I called you is that I sure would like to see you and talk about some things. So the next day, in between his therapy sessions, I walked in and sat for an hour while he talked. The details he gave me ruined my day. I won't ruin yours by repeating them. But right at the end, he got around to what I think he really wanted to talk about with me: his struggles with faith and doubt, recalling how he and I had talked about religion a few times. The Bible says God is love, he reminded me, saying the word slowly and with great labor. He paused and went somewhere deep inside himself for a moment, thinking about it, and he said, I believe that. I believe that God is love. Now, let me tell you, it's one thing to hear a healthy, well-fed minister pronounce that from a pulpit, but the voltage is unbelievable when you hear a man say it to whom life has twice turned her darkest face. And then he said the other thing, the one that made last week's sermon more relevant than I knew when I spoke it, and which made this sermon inevitable. He said, "I hope this doesn't shock you, but I have thought about it a lot. And I have come to believe that God must not be all powerful. For the first time, and only for an instant, his eyes filled with tears, and he could not go on to explain what he meant, but he did not have to. We know exactly how his mind had worked. No love which the human heart can comprehend would allow such a life as Ray's if it had the power to prevent it or to make it better. At 40, the nerve impulses are failing. Fluid is collecting in the lungs. Congestive heart failure is inevitable. He explained it all very carefully to me. And when it was time for me to go, he asked me to pardon him for the tears and thanked me for coming, and then said very quietly, this man who believes in God's love but doubts that God is all-powerful, please pray for me. I went from his room to another place where I had to sit in an office for a while, and where I leafed through some little devotional magazines that were lying on the table. It was my day for coincidences. I'm sure my reaction would not have been so strong if I had not just come from Ray Shepherd's hospital room. You see, the magazines were all singing the power of positive thinking. Forget the ifs in your life, one of them said, and you will discover that your prayers are always answered. Just learn to think well of yourself, another one said, and you will get the life you want to live. Say three times before breakfast, this is the day which the Lord hath made. I will rejoice and be glad in it, and life will get better. I know enough about self-hypnosis to know that this will often work. But I know enough about the Christian faith to know that they are not the same thing. A fine man, Norman Vincent Peale, and his disciples have revived the old auto-suggestion techniques made popular a couple of generations ago by Dr. Emile Couet, whose formula some of you will remember. You were to say over and over each day, every day in every way, I'm getting better and better. You said it, and within limits, it worked. as within limits, the power of positive thinking can work. But the little magazines I was reading took it far beyond Dr. Kuei and his useful secular advice. They said, invoke the help of God, and I'm quoting the next, I wouldn't want you to think these were my words, through deep prayers that have a lot of suction, and get what you want. I read a typical case. A saleswoman, unable to sell her vacuum cleaners, poured out her tale of woe to a customer who took pity on her and said, repeat this formula before every house call. If God be for me, who can be against me? If God be for me, then I know that with God's help, I can sell vacuum cleaners. The upshot of the story was that she went out and sold vacuum cleaners. And in Dr. Peel's words, now she declares, God helps me to sell vacuum cleaners. And who can dispute it? May I be one? If to speak from this pulpit, I must believe that kind of claptrap, that the eternal and transcendent God of this universe is a useful partner in the free enterprise system, right down to the peddling of vacuum cleaners, but has no help for my friend or for the millions like him who lie hidden away in the hospitals and care homes and asylums of this world, if I have to pretend, even for the sake of social courtesy, that I believe in that kind of success-oriented religion, I would have to look for something else to do before this day's sun sets. I'm not as facile as the people who wrote in those magazines. I cannot explain to you why Ray suffers so much if God loves him. I cannot explain the incredible suffering and heartaches of the innocent all over this world. But I stare at the cute little song printed in that magazine, and I refuse to believe that it sums up the final truth about the Christian faith. Accentuate the positive. Eliminate the negative. Latch on to the affirmative, and don't mess with Mr. In Between. Cute, sugar-coated, and half-true, but finally as shallow as a farm pond this summer in western Kansas. I will accentuate the positive and latch on to the affirmative whenever my heart and head will let me. But I won't eliminate the negative, because life won't let me do that and still be honest. And no use telling me not to mess with Mr. In Between, because that's exactly where most of my life, most of anybody's life, is spent. Between faith and doubt, between light and darkness, between the moments when we think we understand and the moments when we are confused and broken. I have seen too much to build my faith on the premise that God is cuddly. I would never think to call him, in a serious moment, the man upstairs, as if he were a friendly rumor in our big boarding house. This awful and terrible God, who knocked even the giant rebel Job to his knees, and to whom Jesus of Nazareth cried out in his dying, "Where are you? Why have you left me?" God as pal, God as a security blanket, God as a kind of substitute for all the warm fuzzies you've ever hugged to your heart. It must be appealing, because there are so many of those little magazines and so many people who read them and find comfort. I have to confess to you that I know less and less about that kind of God. And perhaps that will be a bit of a disappointment to someone. But I do latch on to a few affirmatives, and I would like you to have them last in your mind when you leave. I believe that when I met Ray's wife on Wednesday, not in his room, but working, so that she could help pay their bills, support and sustain him, something that I can know of God was present. And when his nurse walked in and hid her exhaustion at the end of the day to give him a smile and a happy greeting, something of God was present. And even when the ordinary and rather helpless minister sat there and held his hand, the love of God was present. And doing in this strange and so often dark world what it could. Is that the final irony of life? That whoever and whatever God may be, he has to use us.